Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Sexual Selection, A Very Short Introduction by Marlene Zook and Lee W. Simmons, narrated by Randy Kay. Chapter 1. Darwin's Other Big Idea. Anglerfish are some of the oddest-looking fish in the sea. They sport a wide mouth filled with needle-sharp teeth, above which dangles a slim, fleshy protuberance that gives the species its name and acts like a fishing lure to entice prey so that they can be gobbled up by these deep-sea predators. When scientists first discovered anglerfish, they were puzzled that all of their specimens were female, although some had smaller, apparently parasitic fish attached to their bodies. The parasites, a fraction of the size of the host fish, turned out to be not another species, but male anglerfish, living essentially as sacks of sperm, waiting to spawn when the female is ready. Other animals might not show quite such extreme sexual differences, but examples abound of males and females differing in appearance and behavior. Male songbirds, such as goldfinches, are often more colorful than females and are the sex that produces the musical song, while female spiders may be several times the size of males. Female baboons develop colorful rump swellings at the time when they are sexually receptive, and male bowerbirds construct elaborate arenas in which they enact vigorous performances of song and dance to attract potential mates. The idea that males and females often look, sound, smell, and behave differently is uncontroversial. Where those differences come from, however, and what role they play in various species, including humans, is not. And just as Charles Darwin explained how natural selection could produce the variety of organisms on the planet, he also tackled the question of sexual differences in his 1871 book, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex. Many people assume that this book is about human evolution, but its primary focus is on his other big idea, in addition to natural selection, sexual selection. Natural selection, of course, is the differential reproduction of organisms based on their ability to survive, but sexual selection is differential reproduction based on sexual competition, whether between the members of one sex for access to the other, or by selection of particular mating partners. Darwin was not completely alone in his investigations into sex, just as others had laid the groundwork for his ideas about the origins of biodiversity. A number of earlier scientists and scholars had pondered the question of why the sexes differ. Over two centuries before the publication of Darwin's major works, the English physician William Harvey, probably best known for his discovery of the circulation of blood, mused on the ability of a rooster, ornamented with his comb and beautiful feathers, by which he charms his mates to the rites of Venus. Because the passions of sex, as well as war, were viewed as primitive and undesirable, some 18th-century philosophers attempted to determine the origin of such urges, and the famous writer and scholar Jean-Jacques Rousseau was determined to show that so-called savages in a state of nature were pure and good, while the baser desires were an invention of society. This separation of humans, not only from other animals, but from their ancestors, may have contributed to the difficulty we have today in linking the behavior of non-humans with humans. Darwin himself was keen to understand the source of sexual differences in both. He carefully distinguished between traits used for survival, often the result of natural selection on the ability to find food or avoid predators, and those used in acquiring mates. He pointed out that while many animals exhibit extreme traits, in some cases these traits are found in both sexes and turn out to be beneficial in daily life, like the elongated curved bills of Hawaiian honeycreepers, which are used for probing flowers for nectar. but other traits, including those obviously needed for reproduction, such as ovaries and testes, as well as the less apparently functional horns and antlers on sheep and deer, or the sweeping trains of male peacocks, only appear in one sex. Differences in reproductive parts directly involved in sperm or egg production were relatively easy to explain, and Darwin called these primary sexual characteristics. They include the gonads and other aspects of internal and external genitalia. Although they are generally confined to one sex and exist at birth or hatching as they will throughout life, some animals may be hermaphrodites, in which the sex organs of both males and females occur in the same individual. In other animals, including some kinds of fishes and some invertebrates, an animal's sex and sex organs may change during its lifetime, so that, for example, a female blue-streaked cleanorasse will transform into a male if the male in her social group is removed. In clownfish, on the other hand, males may become females if their mate dies or disappears. While some aspects of primary sexual characteristics also may be subject to elaboration, such as the structure of sperm or the morphology of a sexual organ, they have an obvious role in enabling gametes to come into contact and produce a zygote. The other kinds of sexual differences, ranging from rooster combs to cricket chirps, were more difficult for Darwin to understand. In addition to not being needed to ensure that sperm meets egg, many of these characteristics are actually detrimental to survival, either because they require physiological energy to produce or because their conspicuousness makes their bearer vulnerable to predators. For example, in frogs and crickets, calling males expend up to 20 times more energy than they do when at rest. The long tails of boat-tailed grackles, North American birds related to orioles, make it difficult to fly in a high wind, while the bright orange color patches of male guppies make them easy to spot by predatory fish in the streams where the guppies display. Darwin called these traits secondary sexual characters and noted that in many cases they did not seem to have arisen through natural selection. How could the bearers of long and unwieldy tail feathers have been favored by selection over their less elaborated counterparts? Darwin said that sexual selection, which he distinguished at the start from natural selection, had led to their evolution. Like natural selection, sexual selection is a process that results from differential representation of genes in successive generations. In both processes, some individuals have characteristics better suited to the environment. With natural selection, those characteristics mean being able to elude predators, shelter from the elements, or find food. But merely surviving because of the ability to eat and not get eaten is not enough. If an animal lives but doesn't reproduce, it may as well not have bothered, at least from an evolutionary perspective. Survival of the fittest doesn't matter unless the fittest also have offspring. Under sexual selection, then, the crucial traits that determine whether an individual reproduces depend on sexual competition rather than survival ability. The secondary sexual characters, he proposed, could evolve in one of two ways. First, they could be useful to one sex, usually males, in fighting for access to members of the other sex. Hence, the antlers and horns on male ungulates, like bighorn sheep, or the aptly named rhinoceros beetles. These are weapons, and they are advantageous because better fighters get more mates and have more offspring, passing on their combative prowess to their sons. The second way, however, was less intuitive. Darwin noted that female animals often pay attention to traits like loud songs and elaborate plumage during courtship, and he concluded that the traits evolved because the females preferred them. Peahens find males with long trains, the correct term for the fan-shaped set of tail feathers, attractive, just as we humans do, and such characteristics are ornamental. The sexual selection process, then, consisted of two components: male-to-male competition, which results in weapons, and female choice, which results in ornaments. When the sexes differ in their appearance, we call them sexually dimorphic. Species vary considerably in the degree of sexual dimorphism. In the anglerfish, of course, dimorphism is extreme, while in many seabirds, for example, the sexes are almost indistinguishable. The battle over female choice. While competition among males for the right to mate with a female seemed reasonable enough to Darwin's Victorian contemporaries, virtually none of them could swallow the idea that females, of any species, but especially the so-called dumb animals, could possibly do anything as complex as discriminating between males with slightly different plumage colors. Many of those who found Darwin's ideas about natural selection unacceptable were even less enthused about sexual selection, and their objections focused primarily on female choice. The difficulties that scientists of the day had with sexual selection mirror some of those that still dog the concept, including the degree to which the principles of mate choice applied to humans as well as non-human animals. Although the publication of The Descent of Man was not met with the same opposition as On the Origin of Species over a decade earlier, its explicit, for the time, discussions of sex and reproduction were greeted with disapproval. The book was thought to encourage immoral acts and to rationalize what people viewed as reprehensible behavior. Darwin referred to animals having wives as well as concubines, and the moral implications for humans were quite explicit, at least to readers at the time. The 19th century saw many efforts at explaining the differences between human males and females, partly as fuel in the burgeoning women's suffrage movement, and Darwin's book fell squarely into the debate. From the very start, parallels between animals and humans were drawn as people strove to find natural differences between the sexes. Social context was virtually always present, and then, just as now, people used animals as examples of behavior they thought people should or should not emulate. The naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace, who also independently arrived at some of the same conclusions about evolution and natural selection at nearly the same time as Darwin, was particularly vehement in his objections. He and many others simply found it absurd that females could make the sort of complex decision required by Darwin's theory. It would require the female to possess an aesthetic sense like that of humans, an idea they were unwilling to accept. After all, according to the thinking of his time, even among humans, only those of the upper social classes could appreciate finer aspects of civilization, such as art and music, so it seemed ridiculous to imagine that animals could do something many people, particularly non-Englishmen, could not. Darwin tried to emphasize that choice could be defined differently in different kinds of animals, and that insects were probably the lowest forms in which one could expect to see sexual selection, including female choice. At the same time, he was reluctant to depart from conventional ideas about courtship in human societies, and suggested that at least among less barbarous groups, men took the initiative in choosing, which fitted in better with the concept of women as passive and coy. At the same time, Darwin proposed that choice could help distinguish modern humans from their supposedly more promiscuous and primitive ancestors. Wallace and other scientists at the time differed from Darwin in subscribing to the more generally held view of a sharp distinction between humans and other animals. In contrast to Darwin's view that continuity across living things existed, even if humans had unique characteristics. This lack of human exceptionalism, so to speak, was one of the reasons that Darwin's ideas were so revolutionary and why people continued to object to evolution as an explanation for the origin and diversity of life. Furthermore, Darwin was emphatic that his theories applied not only to differences in morphology and appearance, but to behavior, another extension of thought that made some of his contemporaries uncomfortable. Some writers at the time wryly noted that Darwin actually gave more credit for independent thought to animals than to women, who were presumed to submit to their parents or other outside forces in choosing a husband. The mere notion that female animals, and by extension women, would respond sexually to male advances was also viewed with alarm, and Darwin had several exchanges with his publisher over terms such as allure and excite in reference to females. And a few feminists argued that if women were given more power to choose, society would benefit because women were viewed as being altruistic as opposed to the more selfish and egotistical male. Regardless, numerous aspects of the theory of sexual selection proved to be controversial. The idea of female choice in the context of Western marriage also came up against another idea popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, eugenics, which promoted the selective breeding of humans to increase the prevalence of desirable characteristics like intelligence and decrease the likelihood of what was often called feeble-mindedness. Women were thought to shape the future of humanity by choosing eugenically sound husbands, which meant that beauty and other frivolous criteria were not seen as important. Eventually, the ideas of eugenics were used to justify the concept of a master race, familiar to us in the form of Nazism. Even after the Second World War, when Nazism was denounced, sexual selection may have been tarred with the same brush, and this guilt by association may have been why it was subsequently neglected by biologists. In contrast to Darwin, Wallace proposed that the sexes differed not because of female preference for more ornamented males, but because the excess energy and vigor demonstrated in male activity had to be manifested somewhere, and the production of bright colors or loud songs seemed like a logical outlet. He suggested that the ancestral state for both sexes was conspicuousness, and that subsequent selection for females to be cryptic as they sat on the nest or cared for their young produced the dimorphism we often see. Wallace and others also questioned the reason a female might have for choosing one male over another. If the only difference between them was the secondary sexual trait, why should the female bother? Wallace's view on male vigor, leading to bright coloration or other ornaments, was not widely held and does not hold up to modern scrutiny. For one thing, what exactly does it mean to have an excess of vigor? How could such a property, even if it could be defined, lead to a particular physiological manifestation, such as a long tail or a loud song? Despite the absence of an alternative explanation for the evolution of elaborate sexual ornaments, puzzlement over how female choice could operate nonetheless led to near neglect of the entire idea of sexual selection for the next several decades. Sexual selection and the modern synthesis. Although a statistician named Ronald A. Fisher developed mathematical models in his 1930 book, The Genetical Theory of Natural Selection, about how a seemingly detrimental ornament could evolve in only one sex, few biologists were concerned with sexual selection at the dawn of the 20th century. In the first decades of the century, several biologists began to combine the new findings in genetics with Darwin's ideas to produce what is often called the modern synthesis. George Gaylord Simpson, Theodosius Dobzhansky, Robert Ledyard Stebbins, J.B.S. Haldane, and their contemporaries developed a theory about how fast evolution occurs, the relative importance of natural selection and random processes such as genetic drift, and how new species formed. Their work formed the foundation of contemporary evolutionary biology and is still widely cited today. For the most part, however, these major figures were simply uninterested in sexual selection. When they discussed extravagant traits of animals at all, they were suggested to have arisen to allow females to find a mate of the right species. Mating with another species is usually disadvantageous because the resulting hybrids are often less able to survive and reproduce than the parental strains. For example, a male horse can mate with a female donkey to produce what is called a hinny, while a female horse and a male donkey can mate and have what is called a mule. But mules and hinnies can't themselves make any babies, and in other species, even the first generation of such a cross between two species is unsuccessful. So species recognition is clearly important, and the early evolutionary biologists simply dismissed any other role for mate choice. Even Ernst Mayr, the distinguished scientist who developed ideas about speciation in the early 20th century, did not give much credence to female choice as Darwin conceived it, saying, "There are many difficulties in distinguishing between the different possible roles of display traits, even when these characters have only a single function. For example, it is now recognized that many phenomena previously thought to promote intraspecific sexual selection are actually specific recognition marks." In retrospect, it seems surprising that the extraordinary variety of secondary sexual characteristics were all deemed to serve merely to distinguish one species from another. Why some animal groups, such as birds of paradise, seem to require elaborate feathers and a rainbow of colors combined with energetic courtship displays, while others, such as gulls or some sparrows, could discern an appropriate mate based on a difference in leg color or a streak of gray on the head, was never explained. Researchers in animal behavior at the time were similarly dismissive of the mere idea of female choice, presuming that choice was a rational process that then, by necessity, was confined to humans. Animals, they noted, were uncivilized, and hence the process simply could not occur in them. Furthermore, it appeared to the early zoologists that female animals were passive creatures that mated with whichever male could dominate them and fend off his rivals, and physiologists focused on the mechanisms leading to sexual differences, such as hormones, rather than on the evolutionary processes that would have selected them in the first place. The famous zoologist Julian Huxley made a detailed study of courtship in the great-crested grebe, a water bird, and concluded that the complex displays by both sexes before pairing occurred were needed to overcome the female's natural reluctance to engage in copulation. It would appear that his own biases about the nature of males and females led him to make assumptions that were not necessarily warranted, as we will hear in the remaining chapters. Interestingly, although he, like other scientists, did not believe female animals could choose, Huxley did favor the idea that monogamy came naturally to animals other than humans. Other efforts to examine mate choice in the laboratory or field were made during the time of the modern synthesis, often using the common representative animal for studies in genetics, the fruit fly Drosophila. When presented with a female, male Drosophila perform an elaborate courtship dance, sometimes accompanied by songs produced by rapid wing movements. Both sexes also respond to chemicals on the surface of the body. Males will often begin to court unsuitable targets, including immature females or other males, but will generally cease unless they perceive additional stimuli, such as the odor produced by a receptive female. It is possible that the flies were favorites for sexual selection research because it was more difficult to anthropomorphize them than birds or other vertebrates, or perhaps they were simply more available for study. Despite these early efforts, in 1948, Angus John Bateman published a still widely cited paper in which he pointed out that the evidence for sexual selection was mainly circumstantial and attempted to determine why it was general law that the male is eager for any female without discrimination, whereas the female chooses the male. Bateman reported on experiments with Drosophila, purporting to show that males continue to benefit with increasing numbers of matings, while female reproductive success plateaus after only a few mates. He concluded that because a male can fertilize many females, but females can lay only a limited number of eggs, male variance in reproductive success, the degree to which males differ in how many offspring they sire, is expected to be greater than female variance in reproductive success. This then suggested that sexual selection would act more strongly on males than on females. Other mid-20th century researchers on mate choice in fruit flies found some of the earliest evidence for genes influencing behavior, another topic that continues to be hotly debated. They also described in detail the complex variations in mating behavior that occurred under different circumstances. Claudine Petit, a French scientist who took up her studies after serving in the French Resistance in the Second World War, was convinced that sexual selection had been needlessly neglected and performed numerous experiments on several different strains of the flies, demonstrating that sexual selection could be responsible for genetic variation in wild populations. Perhaps because her work was published in French, it was not widely known. Influential scientists of the time, such as Theodosius Dobzhansky, however, were still unconvinced that animals, whether insects such as the fruit flies or vertebrates such as Huxley's grebes, actually demonstrated anything that could be called discrimination or preference. The importance of individual preference. There matters stood, more or less, until roughly the 1960s, when ideas about animal behavior and evolution began to shift away from a species-centered view and towards the recognition that individual differences were important. Biologists seemed to pay more attention to the ways that selection acted on individual variation rather than on the similarities among members of a species and the overwhelming need to avoid hybrid mating. In addition, people began to question the notion of a passive, acquiescent female and to wonder how exactly female choice could be enacted. In Chapter 2, we examine the variation in how males and females associate during the breeding season, ranging from brief couplings with multiple partners to lifelong monogamy. We also see how the discovery that females mate with many partners, even in supposedly monogamous species such as songbirds, was made possible by modern genetic techniques. Variation in mating systems holds considerable implications for the operation of sexual selection. Chapter 3 will give a contemporary view of mate choice and its occurrence in a wide variety of animal species, along with some examples of what females are choosing and why parasites and disease may play a role in the evolution of extravagant secondary sexual characteristics. In Chapter 4, we will examine the notion, implicit in many of the original ideas about sexual selection, that males and females have natural roles, with characteristic behavior associated with each sex. In chapter 5, we see that sexual selection continues long after the physical act of mating is over, as sperm compete inside a female's reproductive tract and females bias the paternity of their young by selectively using sperm from particular males. Chapter 6 explores the ways in which benefits to males that accrue as part of mating may be detrimental to females, and vice versa, processes that seem to
Sample complete. Ready to continue?